"Ha, ha," said Richard Dawkins. "Over 2 million have bought my book, and I've had many letters, not 2 million, obviously, from people saying they now no longer believe in God. So what do you think about that?" And God smiled, because she enjoyed a joke as much as the next monotheist creator. Decoration. Once, passenger pigeons could be scooped from the sky. One flock, 300 miles long, took 14 hours to pass. 3.5 billion birds, a large fraction of the population. Slaughter took place on a massive and mechanized scale. 2 cents a pair, cheap meat. Always plenty to replace them. What did a few more matter? Or eggs unhatched? Tuesday, 1st of September, 1914. Martha, last of the species, lay lifeless in her cage in Cincinnati Zoo, while 6,500 men were taken by surprise at Newry. Captain Bradbury led L Battery, lost a leg, then lost his life. They put his picture on a cigarette card for small boys to swap. Their older sisters kept other photos safe forever. Sergeant Nelson, badly wounded, survived to fight for 4 more years. Sergeant Major Dorrell, veteran of the Boer War, manned the last remaining gun till all the shot was gone. Martha's molting skin was mounted on a branch, propped up with preformed polystyrene, beside a male pigeon shot 40 years earlier, he being the only one available.
Today I am joined by Kat Dale. Thank you so much for coming.
Home for Kat Dale is definitely York. In her writing, she draws on the conflicting emotional experiences of growing up on a farm and spending adult life in the city. Her book, Dislocation, explores human interactions and the strategies women develop to survive and flourish. Her personal interpretation of nature and the human condition finds expression in ceramic sculpture. She takes recreational ceramics classes for undergrads and postgrads at York University. So, turning to one of the poems you just read, Decoration, how does your poem Decoration reflect your interest in the position of women in society?
Yes, very much so. World War I saw a huge loss of life. Only one of the 3 soldiers awarded the VC after the Battle of Newry in the poem survived the war. And after the 1921 census, Lord Northcliffe referred to Britain's problem of 2 million superfluous women. So women who had been valued for their contribution to the war effort and absolutely essential in the Second World War were now expected to creep back to being housewives, except now husbands were in short supply. Mm-hmm. So, as you say, I'm fascinated by the strategies that women throughout history have adopted to survive and to flourish. And this is central to my novel.
Right, so you focus on women and on the strategies they develop to survive. So I see that you have chosen very particular and specific terms to phrase this idea. I'm referring to strategies and survive. So do you believe that life is a struggle, especially for women? And if you do, how did you come about this conclusion?
Well, I do appreciate that I'm very lucky living in an essentially secular democracy. And in my own lifetime, I've seen great strides towards equal treatment for women. But attitudes actually take a lot longer to change than legislation would suggest, mm-hmm. as much as friends will testify. For instance, in meetings, they tell me that women are still more likely to be interrupted or talked over. And that mm-hmm. old, "Oh, that's an interesting idea, Miss X. Perhaps one of the men would like to suggest it," is still true. Mm-hmm. Not that they have any objection to men in the workplace. It gets them out of the house and gives them something interesting to talk about when their wives get home.
Right. Your book, Dislocation, is about a woman, Jane, swapping her high-heeled shoes for a pair of wellies so that she may kidnap 12 geese. I find this idea rather interesting, original, and quite unexpected. I wouldn't really put the 3 things together. How did it come to you? I'm curious to know, what is the story behind the story?
Nothing very exciting, really. I used to drive to work along Hull Road. The 2 carriages separate just before the A64 flyover, and there's a small triangular field in between. And for 3 or 4 years, the geese were kept there. And I used to watch them as, at the queue at the roundabout. Mm. And the idea just came as slowly into my head as every day as I was drumming my fingers on the steering wheel, waiting for the lights to change.
Right, that's quite creative. So have you written any other novels?
Oh, alas, to date I'm just a one-book writer. That's not to say that I've only got the proverbial one novel in me, but it's more a reflection on my writing process.
Right. And then your writing process, how do you actually go about writing?
Oh, very inefficiently, I'm afraid. I'm just constantly editing. So blame this on my grammar school education. It was, the influence of teachers can be long-lasting.
I can totally empathise.
So on my next poem, the name tapes have been changed to avoid detention.
Right.
What's their life beyond the 3:45 bell? The worst period was Monday afternoon with killer whale, conjugating on a stomach full of stewed cabbage, a mow a mass without the option of declining. Each morning she'd wade into assembly, harpooning the floor of the hall on 6-inch stilettos. We'd slow flow past, mouthing the last amen, while she measured the distance between knocking knees and mini-skirted tunics. 6 inches was way too much, and if we chanced to loose our hair below the collar, she was ready with scissors and string. We thought we'd seen the last of her, the day we hugged and handed in our primers, tied our plimsolls to the bike shed, threw our notebooks in the bin. Sometime later, on the high street, a car pulled in the gap I'd spotted first. Still flashing amber, I got out and hammered on the glass. The driver's window wound halfway. Miss Kilway looked out, ticking over. I muffled through my college stripes. You're in my space. At an old school tie reunion, I heard she'd died in a nursing home after years of suffering. It was, they said, a great relief.
A very beautiful poem.
Thank you.
You personally, as a writer that publishes both poetry and prose, do you have any advice to give to people that want to write?
Oh, dear. I suppose, well, the usual advice is to knock off at least 5,000 words before breakfast without even pausing to punctuate. Well, I'm afraid I can't think, never mind write, without punctuation. So, oh, here's my protagonist, Jane, who's beginning to realise her partner isn't as wonderful as she thought. Breakfast was almost companionable. She watched his lips form syllables, which were no doubt getting together to make words, sentences, paragraphs. Did people talk in paragraphs? Probably, if the other person, let's call her the listener, didn't do a bit of syllable making in response. His lips had got stuck on a semicolon. It definitely wasn't a full stop, because they were slightly parted, so Jane could see the tips of his incisors. Incisors which didn't know what his toothbrush had been up to. She smiled, and the semicolon reinvented itself as a smiley face, and there they sat, all smiles together. She'd heard it took fewer muscles than frowning. But when he placed his lips on hers and pushed them out and in, she found it took no muscles at all to be absolutely unmoved.
As I was looking through and reading some extracts of your novel Dislocation, I was wondering exactly which genre does your novel fall into?
I don't really think it fits any particular genre. It's probably one of the reasons why I failed to wow an agent. And I can see the commercial sense in selecting a popular genre and following a prescribed format, and I really admire anyone who makes a living from this. But it was quite gratifying the other day to learn that Marlon James, the recent Man Booker Prize winner, had his debut novel rejected nearly 80 times.
Yes. So, talking about agents and getting published, how did you get published yourself?
Well, I'm afraid I didn't show as much persistence as Marlon James before going down the self-publishing route. But on the plus side, this meant I had full control of my book, so I didn't have to bend to someone else's views. Because opinions on a novel, or even its jacket, mine, by the way, is a photo of a pair of red sandals from somewhere in my youth, discarded in the snow. They're entirely subjective, as with all art.
Yes, definitely. I do agree.
Our next poem is Critical Spectrum. A was an abstract, artist unknown. B bought it, could be worth a bit one day. C copied it for a secret commission. D donated it, the dedicated plaque. E enthused over it to a junior colleague. F framed it, had to cut it down to fit. G gawped at it. What was it supposed to be, anyway? H hung it in an adjacent room with the Pollux. I installed it under a too-high spotlight. J judged it to be of marginal significance. K kicked it, activated the sprinkler alarm. L loved it, but daren't let on. What did she know? M missed it, taking a wrong turn after Mondrian. N nudged it 10 degrees. No one noticed. O ostracised it. Didn't go for this modern stuff. P patronised it on the optional guided tour. Q questioned the cogency of its basic philosophy. R reviewed it for The Guardian and Tomorrow's Chips. S scorned it, said a child of 6 could do better. T touched it, intent on tactile interaction. U understood it. His wife didn't, but then she wouldn't. V videoed it for local television. Never shown. W wanted it, made do with a postcard from the shop. X x-rayed it for underlying insurrectionary texts. Y yodeled at it, was ejected by security. Z zero-rated it, and the exhibition closed.
That's quite a nice poem, because you have all the alphabet starting each line. I quite like it. Your previous answer, you said that art is entirely subjective. So both writing and sculpting are forms of art, right? And
yes.
How do you manage to blend the two of them together?
Well, like most of my writing, many of my sculptures are sort of interpretations of the human condition. And again, particularly that of the female, both historically in modern society and in legend and allegory.
Right. What do you think, then, it is important to connect to our artistic side? So what I'm asking is, how do you also channel your creative impulse into sculpting, and is it similar to the way in which you channel it into creative writing?
I suppose it's similar, in that sculpture is shaping clay into the tangible expression of an idea, and writing shaping words to convey meaning. The visual and tactile quality of sculpture equate to the sound and the rhythm of poetry and prose.
I really like the idea of shaping words. I really like it. In your introduction, we said that you teach ceramics classes to undergrad and postgraduate students at York.
Yes, that's right.
Since art as a concept and as a way of feeling about life is probably constantly mutating and, we may say, reshaping itself after each of our human experiences,
Yeah.
Do you find that your art is influenced by teaching others? So do your students inspire you in some way or another?
I think their main inspiration comes from their vibrancy and zest for life. People, especially young people, are so interesting. Incidentally, for any students who don't know about the art studios at Wentworth, that's a brilliant and extremely good value opportunity to try or to develop skills in painting, printmaking and ceramics. So for full details, search York Uni Art Studios. And it's also a great opportunity to meet students from different faculties, different cultures.
That's really interesting. I did not know about that,
and
I'll definitely pay a visit.
Yeah, it's been there years, apparently. Yeah, absolutely.
Carrying on, have you experienced any recreational classes from the other side as a mature student yourself?
Yes, I have. When I picked up on ceramics after quite a lapse, after my degree, which was many years ago, life sort of got taken up with stuff like children and a full-time career. So the course was fun. And it wasn't just my ceramic skills that were refreshed. Adult education class. As we coil with terracotta, raku, crank and speckled flecks, conversation turns, as always, from unfired hand-shaped pots to sex. Seen Life Sue, pre-menopausal, discloses places she's been kissed, tells us thrice a day's normal, clicks her tongue at what we've missed. We curl our lips, we're no suckers, and phlox is what our beds are for. 3 times a day, scoffs Been There Betty, I'd sooner scrub the ruddy floor. I should mention that phlox is a low-maintenance bedding plant, which performs well against a shady wall.
So I see that in your poems, in some way or another, go back to your life and to your personal experiences. So I wonder, is your novel in any way autobiographical? Are you actually Jane, the protagonist?
I'm often asked if it's autobiographical. And the more I've thought about it, the more I realise it's impossible for a writer to be completely detached from her writing. And anyway, an autobiography is a slightly blinkered version of the truth, because it's a writer's own interpretation of what happened. We all distort events and motives, emotions, or sometimes deliberately, because we feel the need to justify our behaviour. Mm-hmm. So autobiography has come into my novel in different ways, but probably the most obviously through reality, through different people and places and such I've experienced. Rather than Jane being based on me, I found that she took me over, actually, because at first I had to make a conscious effort to think about Jane, about what she'd say and do. Mm-hmm. But gradually, sort of like Mr. Hyde, she materialised in my mind, unbidden, so that I began to exist in this unreal world of my imagination with Jane looking down on me. And so I went to sleep as Jane and I woke as Jane and probably dreamt as Jane in between.
Then do you mind telling me a bit more about the story? It's such an interesting story.
Well, the blurb says, Jane swaps her high heels for a pair of wellies to rescue 12 getting fat geese, but can she kick off Oliver's domination? So on the surface, it's sort of quite a light book, an amusing tale, really, of a girl, some geese, an ancient tractor, and a lot of snow. But underlying this is an exploration of the emotional and sexual manipulation within relationships. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had a mishap in a car because she's been driving in her wellies. Jane certainly has. Ahead, green changed to amber. Jane put her foot down. You can do it, Faustina. And she would have done. Easy peasy. The door in front slammed. Jane watched the driver go to the back of his Toyota and bend over. Though she was confident such a very little bump mightn't have caused much damage, she found reverse. She'd give him a few inches. It was the least she could do. She eased the clutch. Her welly slipped, caught the right side pedal, and the horn behind was a wolf howling at the moon for all the good it did. Toyota man realised he'd got off lightly, which was more than he would do if he missed the kid's bedtime story for the 4th night in a row. As the lights changed, Jane saw his scratched bumper bar disappearing into someone else's night, leaving just the one to face. They got out of their vehicles and came together, where Festina's rear was on intimate terms with the snout of his Cortina. Should she go for, it wasn't my fault, you must have moved forward, or little Miss Helpless? You could usually tell by looking at the eyes. She looked. She knew those eyes. Had known them a lot madder. In fact, as he looked from Jane, in her mud-caked wellies, to his cracked bumper, with her tow bar somehow jammed underneath, the creases of skin upturned, and Simon began to laugh. On the hilarity scale, she wouldn't have put it above 3.5, but it beat road rage.
I absolutely need to ask you, have wellies played a big part in your life?
Oh, well, I was brought up on a farm, so wellies and welly socks were essential. Since leaving school, I've lived in town and then city, so I've definitely become a townie as far as footwear's concerned. And I've very much got used to living in the town. But what I haven't got used to is the urban disconnection between the animal in the field or shed and the package on the supermarket shelf. Mm-hmm. This is Jane loading her trolley. Each one weighed exactly 2.2 kilograms, so there was nothing to choose between them. As long as they didn't have one of those squashy little bags inside, she didn't care. She wanted a main course, not a digestive history. Not that there'd be its own giblets, Simon had told her. It was one of the things she'd learned that night. When they'd been plucked, those that had any feathers left, and gutted, bags were stuffed in randomly. Dead flesh, with another creature's heart frozen inside.
Is your... You said you were brought up in a farm, so is your rural upbringing a significant factor in the shaping of your novel?
Yes, I guess it's an essential part, really. And some things that I regard as personal experiences are actually memories that have been handed down. I remember, for instance, my mum telling me about helping to dress geese for the Christmas market when she was a little girl. And here's Jane talking to an old farmer's wife. "I'd be about 10 when I first helped," said Mrs. Wainwright. "Everyone had to knuckle in. I never did like to see him killed, though. Mind you, if you started plucking while they were still twitching, feathers came off a lot easier. We wrapped a bit of cloth round the head to stop the blood getting on them, because we kept our best feathers without quills. Mother made all our beds and pillows. Made me one when I was married. Them polystyrene duvies you have nowadays aren't a patch on a proper feather eiderdown. Jack and me still have it on the bed. I put new ticking in it a few years back, freshened things up a treat. The feathers were still nice. I think it took about 7 geese. One of them was old Toddy. He didn't go to one of the regulars, of course. He'd be tough as old boots. I don't know how you could after you'd had him so long," said Jane. "It'd be like killing a pet. But old Toddy won't up to his job any more. Mother had had him for donkey's years. But the other geese, they'd had such short lives. They had a good life. We looked after them well. And then you wrung their necks." Mrs. Wainwright shook her head. "A goose's neck takes some pulling. Me da used to cross the wings over the back so the head'd bend down and stick his pocket knife through the brain just above the eyes." She nudged her plate into Jane's ribs. "Go and get us summat else to eat, honey. I'm fair famished."
You seem to be very aware of your place in the genetic line.
Yeah, I feel that everyone, whether they're famous or insignificant, is just a small fragment of the grand scheme, and that we all share the accumulated knowledge and the spiritual connection of mankind. And even fictional characters have these emotional responses. This is Jane, reflecting. Jane forced down the snow-spattered window and peered out. White on white. Were the geese there? How could she be sure? The pupils let in as much as they considered necessary. The rods and cones could be relied on to do their double act. But as soon as the brain got involved, things went pear-shaped. Not satisfied with mere image flipping, it had this compulsion to fill in the blind spots with whatever came to mind, which made your perception as skewed as everyone else's, and your life as screwed up. Her life, it seemed, could not be unscrewed. She shrugged, and the snow wrinkled along the folds of her sleeve. The geese were probably tucked up safely in the ark. There again, were they really anywhere, as visual entities, when no one could see them? Apparently the unheard tree makes no sound as it falls. So does one life depend on another to recognise its existence, for it to exist at all? Was it impossible to be an independent being? Impossible to shake off the collective done and not done thought, word, deed transgressions, since man first chipped breasts and vulval lips into a lump of rock and called her God? Jane looked into the grey shroud sky, greyness closing in, and the nowhere sun a nanospeck further away than yesterday. Newton might as well have tossed the apple on the compost heap for all the chance of her escaping a certain dark energy. Eve had it sussed. Freedom was as unrealistic as any other abstraction in this concrete world. But if the universe was expanding faster than the speed of light, was it asking too much to want a bit of space?
Do you always write from the female point of view?
Usually, but not always. And also, I do try writing from different points of view. This next poem features a lad with a very different lifestyle and hence set of values than those that were passed down to me. I got this one. He had it coming, that'un. I saw him there, sat on the wall, all smug, well-fed, fat mug, fur-brushed, family pet. He never had an empty gut.
or got shoved around and spat on. His skin wasn't marked with scars. He wasn't left locked outside for hours while she shagged. He'd been stroked and hugged. Pampered pussy, I knew. He turned and mewed at me. I poked his arse with a stick. He stuck his paw out, claws out, struck out, got me on the cheek. I swung me stick and knocked him off. Used me skill, got the boot in so his skull was smashed in all the muck. Knelt down, knife out, nicked off his ears, 1, 2. His neck had a blue strap with a buckle and a little disc, solid metal, showing he belonged. Them lugs is hard now. I hanged 'em from me chain for luck. Anyway, that cat had 9 lives.
Going back to your family that I picked up in the poem, do you think that the family influence plays a big part in our lives?
Yes, I don't think you can really get away from family. Whatever your feelings about them, it's difficult to separate yourself from them. My daughter got married earlier this year and she looked fabulous in her Oxfam dress. And we had a great day. And it's at times like this that set you thinking of family members who are no longer there to join in the celebrations. Mm. This is a poem to my daughter, but it's also about my mum. To love and to cherish. She always said she'd buy your wedding dress, but that was then. Today she'd have approved your choice as you walk the aisle in reused white. I'd washed it twice to be sure, thought of her washing mine in the hot point twin tub, good as new. You wear her 3-string pearls, and I the single strand of pink. I watched her fasten round her neck when she was mother of the bride, another life ago. For almost 13 years they've nestled in a silk-lined box, waiting. The roses on her wedding snaps were never grey to me. My child's eye saw the rich dark red, still fresh in the memory of a day I never knew. My own were yellow. Today you carry white and orange, with ribbon tied twice round.
That's very, very sweet. Let me say that.
Thank you.
I'm afraid we're running a bit out of time, but I have one last question that I would like to ask you. And that is, we hope this never happens, but should you ever shipwreck and be given the opportunity to bring only one book with you on a desert island, which book would you salvage and why?
Well, I've read hundreds of books and some of them twice, but to take a favourite one, even if I could pick one, to read over and over ad infinitum would surely make it the most hated book ever. So possibly continuously rereading a poetry compilation wouldn't actually drive me insane. Something thick like the Norton Anthology is quite good. But I think probably my chosen book would be the Oxford Dictionary and Thesaurus. And then at least if I'm ever rescued, I could give a more articulate interview than I have today. But as we're ending with this desert island disc theme, I'd like to finish with this poem, which is written in the shape of a footprint. I know this is completely lost on radio, but I also know that students have brilliant imaginations. And if you could take only one. It took no more than one odd footprint in the sand to tell him he was not here alone, as he'd been led to believe, cast away on some unseen utopian desert island, companionless, apart from the complete works, leather-bound, of Shakespeare, signed, Gideon's unthumbed Bible, and the incessant calling of those sodding gulls. What use now, that carefully chosen luxury item? Ah, well, he thought, as he dug a hole to bury the box of solitaire. At least there would be someone around to wind up the old gramophone.
That's a beautiful way to conclude this interview, also because we have once again put together the written and the visual, as in this point you said it's in the shape of a footprint and I'm looking at it, it's really pretty. So thank you so much for coming here today.
Thank you, it's been great fun.